Something I've learned over time is to never underestimate the power of synchronicity. That's certainly what's come into play with regard to Mark Purdy. Mark is an organic farmer in Britain. He has a background in zoology. Although being a true child of the 1970s, he left school before completing his degree. But the scientific bent of his thinking never left him, and he's employing his natural curiosity and skill in observation in his search for the cause of the spongiform diseases that now plague our cattle, deer, elk, and even humans. My first introduction to Mark Purdy's work came by way of casual talk on a bus tour around central Alberta. I had joined a group of farmers and other rural folks who wanted to see what their neighbors were doing to lower their heating costs. A fellow named Vern was sitting in the bus seat in front of me, and it wasn't long before we started talking about the one mad cow that had turned the Canadian cattle industry upside down. Vern said, "It's the soil, you know," and he pulled out a 10-page document, handed it over the back of the seat to me, and said, "Here, look at this." I took it, more out of politeness than anything else, and glanced over the pages. The type was so small I could hardly read it. But a couple of things on the first page caught my attention, and through the rest of the bus tour, as we traveled from farm to farm over bumpy gravel roads, I did my best to read the article. Vern was somewhat surprised when I handed it back to him at the end of the trip. "I can't believe you read it all," he said. "I haven't even done that." Back home, I looked up the author's website and then contacted him by email, hoping to get a copy of the article sent to me. He wrote saying, what a coincidence, he was coming to Alberta in a couple of weeks. I met up with the author, Mark Purdy, in Leduc, where he was giving a presentation of his findings about chronic wasting disease at the Elk Expo. Among the audience of mostly elk ranchers was a virologist and a professor emeritus. He had traveled all the way from the veterinary college in Saskatoon with his graduate student to hear what Mark had to say. Following is the interview I recorded with Mark Purdy after his lecture. He says, contrary to present thinking, mad cow disease is not highly infectious. The main points that he is investigating and drawing together are the cluster effect of the spongiform phenomena and the synergistic relationship of environmental factors such as copper depletion in the soil or the body, the effect of sound, solar radiation, radioactive compounds, and electromagnetic energy. And these come together in promoting the onset of the disease. As one of the elk ranchers commented as he left at the end of the day, "Mark, you just keep thinking outside the box."
Mark Purdy, I'm a farmer from the UK. I've got a sort of beef suckler herd on the Brendon Hills in Somerset, which is a rather picturesque area of the country where the poets Wordsworth and Coleridge sort of did a lot of their compositions from the Quantock Hills and Exmoor in my area. But I'm also a field research scientist looking at clusters of brain diseases such as the spongiform encephalopathies, mad cow, scrapie, CWD, etc. And I also look at brain diseases like multiple sclerosis, motor neurone disease, Parkinson's and Alzheimer's.
You're from Britain, but you're over here in Alberta, touring around talking about chronic wasting disease and mad cow disease and those sorts of things. What got you started looking at these?
I think it's the experience of having a mad cow that I purchased into my farm, and it's a very nasty disease. And, you know, it's quite frightening to see an animal that you've been working with sort of day and night, you know, suddenly come into your milking parlour with these bizarre, freaky kind of symptoms. And I just wondered what had caused it. That was my first question. And I didn't feel comfortable with what the kind of propaganda that the government's started pumping us with as to the cause of this disease.
What made you uncomfortable?
Well, there were facts like Enmil feed that was blamed on the cause of the disease was actually marketed, exported out of Great Britain, sold all over the world to countries that have never had a single case of BSE. So if microdoses of this feed was responsible for BSE, is what we're being told, then why weren't the mega numbers of breakdowns of BSE in countries like Saudi Arabia, Libya, where they fed boatloads of British meat and bone meal through the vulnerable period?
You've been traveling all over the world trying to gather evidence for what your theories are. What are some of the places that you've gone?
I've gone to a range of areas where spongiform diseases have clustered. I started off in Colorado, where it's been present in a tiny area of the Front Range in the Rockies, near Fort Collins, where the deer and elk have chronic wasting disease. I've been to Iceland, where sheep scurvy is at the highest incidence rate in the world. I've been to three villages in Slovakia, where CJD runs at a high level. One village in Calabria in southern Italy where CJD, they had 20 cases in 5 years in a village of 150 houses. Sardinia, Sicily, where scrapie in sheep and goats and CJD in humans has burst out recently. Japan, where there have been clusters of scrapie in sheep and CJD in certain valleys. Yeah, wherever the disease has manifested itself in a significant way, I've been there, done this total environmental survey, looking at the water, the vegetation and the soil, and then carried out an analysis on about 24 metals and looked for those, the kind of etiological needles in the causal haystack. And I came up with a kind of common toxic denominator, which enabled me to build up a hypothesis that this disease was sort of caused by very low levels of copper and then extremely high levels of certain metals and furthermore metals which can have a radioactive form to them in specific environments.
Is this something that's naturally occurring or is it artificial? Is it man-made? Is it something that we're polluting the environment with?
It's both. I mean, metals like uranium and strontium occur naturally in their radioactive form in certain soil types, and some of these areas are where these clusters have appeared. And of course, as we all know, a lot of radioactive metals were deliberately manufactured into missile technology, bomb technology, trigger technology, and there have been clusters of the disease around these particular areas. For instance, in Colorado, where the first ever case of CWD emerged, the first case developed in this pen that was managed by the Department of Wildlife officials. And during the 60s and 70s, this very pen of deer had been subjected to a whole battery of experiments where they were taken up to the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons facility that in 67 had a major leak of plutonium that was kind of emitted all over the countryside, which is the area which is the chronic wasting disease cluster today. But these deer were deliberately moved between the Fort Collins facility under the care of the Department of Wildlife to the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant, where they were fed and pastured on plutonium contaminated. The experiment was designed to look at the amounts of plutonium in the dung of these animals, etc., etc. And perhaps it was no coincidence that the first case of CWD in 1968, directly after this major leak, was in a deer in this very pen, in this very facility, which had been running these radioactive sort of metal experiments. I think that says a lot. And I found that there's about 4 or 5 PhD theses that are written on these various experiments that were funded by the US Atomic Agency and the US government. And my guess is that the Americans know what the original cause of these diseases was.
What about in some of these other areas?
Well, I found a very cast-iron nuclear link in Calabria, where this village had 20 cases of CJD. Interestingly, they'd actually evacuated this entire village up in the Aspromonte Mountains, and it was subsequent to the evacuation that the 20 of the former villagers went down with CJD. And the evacuation would appear to have been carried out because there'd been dumping of nuclear waste material, illegal dumping by some of the mafia groups in that particular region of Italy. Again, it's hard to believe this is just a coincidence. where, you know, rare contamination with a rare sort of man-made metal seems to correlate with the emergence of these clusters of spongiform encephalopathy.
What about somewhere perhaps natural forms were a problem?
Well, I found that, I think, in Iceland, where, you know, there was a lot of the volcanoes spew out radioactive metals naturally. Thorium, strontium, some cesium comes out as well. And certain of these types of metals combine to this prion protein, which is the protein that causes the spongiform encephalopathy disease when it's in its rogue form. And, you know, I've been collaborating and following the work of Dr. David Brown, a scientist in the UK, and he discovered that this prion protein actually bonds onto copper in the healthy, living, normal brain. And then I hypothesized that perhaps the copper had a role in conducting, a bit like its industrial use in electrical circuit wiring. The copper was conducting electromagnetic energy coming in through the retina, through the brain, in the body, the immune response, reproductive system, sleep-wake rhythms, behavioral patterns. All of these areas are controlled by the circadian daylight-darkness rhythm. And lo and behold, the prion protein appears to be expressed in these particular areas of the body that are under circadian control. For instance, the retina is the most intensive area in the body which it manufactures this prion protein. So the kind of electromagnetic energy, the UV energy, is picked up in the retina on these copper atoms, then conveyed through the circadian pathways in the brain to the areas where, I think the copper sparks off these calcium channels, which are involved in actually igniting the sort of response of what I believe is circadian mediation effects, you know. But when there's no copper there, as I found in these spongiform environments, then that prion protein can take up the rogue metals, become substituted by these rogue radioactive metals that do not act in the best interests of the body. They do not conduct electromagnetic energy coming in through the retina, etc. And what they do is, because they have a different type of magnetic property than copper, they're what's called ferrimagnetic, which means that they can absorb light or sound energy and store it up permanently, then this magnetic metal, the radioactive metal that locks onto the prion protein, instead of conducting the energy, it actually blocks it. It stores it up in magnetic form, just like in a piece of tape, music tape, which absorbs energy into chromium metal, or some manganese 3+ metals are used in music tape material for storing up the energy of music, the phonon energy, as it's called, in magnetic form.
If that's the case, if that's what's happening, what happens then in the brain?
Yeah, well, basically it builds up and up at the quantum sort of scale, accumulates of this energy until you reach saturation point and you get this explosive, you know, not only the magnetic fields are sort of emitted by these magnetically charged metals, and the actual field starts charging up adjoining metals. And so you get a whole, like an infectious magnetic field, encroaches and takes over all the pathways, circadian pathways through the brain. And this is what spongiform disease is. It's when the whole brain becomes contaminated, becomes kind of encapsulated, sort of rogue magnetic field that is infectious. You know, it's like the elementary physics experiment that most of us did at school, where you put a magnet beside a steel nail and then you charge up that steel nail, and then it all clumps together, what's charged up. And this is what happens with rogue prion proteins in the brain. They all clump up together and form a kind of rod-like structure.
What happens to all this charging up energy?
Well, it produces, it sort of unleashes itself by, you know, through the magnetic field, which in itself produces this free radical chain reaction, a kind of meltdown process, you know, like a nuclear meltdown. And it's these free radicals that that cause the damage to the proteins and the membrane materials in the brain, which cause the which are the spongiform lesions.
Well, what makes the prion change its shape? Because that's the thing.
It's the abnormal metal going on. The way the metal folds is often dictated by its metal co-partner. And it's well known with metal protein chemists that if you put the wrong metal on a protein, if it's able to bond on, that is, then the protein will change into the wrong conformation. It's the way that kind of metal proteins operate. You know, they have a useful role in the body, like, as I suggested, a conductor for the prion protein. You know, there are lots of other metals, antioxidant metals, that need to have specific conformation, specific molecular shapes in order to function correctly. But some of these proteins don't have that correct sort of function, and when you've stuck the wrong metal on, then you get this dysfunction.
So you've talked about it. If we have the proper balance of copper, then the energy is being conducted.
Yeah.
But if it's not there and something else is in its place, then you're storing up energy. It sounds like a battery.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I've always likened the CJD brain to a solar charged battery on continuous charge, which in effect is what it is. It's the UV. Once you've got the wrong metal in your brain instead of copper, the UV charges up the wrong metal, and the magnetic charge increases to saturation point, and then you get this pathogenic kind of free radical mediated chain reaction that proliferates and gets out of control. You know, copper's also an antioxidant, so there's none of that around to block the free radical chain reactions.
Now, you've also said that there are other factors involved in this too, and one of them has to do with sound.
Yeah.
What on earth does sound have to do with this?
Yes, I mean, apart from this abnormal metal imbalance in the environments, that there also has to be a sound. It seems to be sound in the low frequency range, which is something we can't actually hear, but it is very, very toxic indeed. And in a way, this low-frequency sound has a high intensity of energy, of phonons, contained within it. And so the wrong metals that are going to absorb that energy are going to, when they're challenged from the external environment by this low-frequency sound shock blasts, which is what I'm finding in the cluster arrays, then that's going to take the metal to the active point much quicker. In the traditional clusters of spongiform disease, like scrapie, they're always found on earthquake fault lines, and that there is this low-frequency noise whenever the tectonic plates start grinding away, often maybe months, even years, before you get an actual eruption. And this seems, the arrows where you get this tectonic movement, where there's earthquakes historically, seem to be the areas where you get spongiform disease. You know, for instance, the Fuji Valley cluster, Fuji volcano, a major fault line, that's in Japan. The cluster in Papua New Guinea is on the main Ring of Fire fault line that runs through the highlands of Papua New Guinea. Even the cases in Wisconsin of the chronic wasting disease cluster, the actual epicenter of the cluster is on an area where, they've had earthquakes, their epicenters in that specific spot over the last century, sometimes reaching 7 on the Richter scale. Again, in Colorado, there's a whole fault line running down the front range of the Rocky Mountains where they've had earthquake eruptions, and that's why the Rockies are there, through the sort of forcing the mountain range up on from that fault line onwards. And some very interesting sort of spin-offs have come from this. For instance, I've been talking with Native Americans about they're very worried they're losing their natural protein source, which is deer in the sort of Wisconsin region, and with these misguided slaughter policies that the Wisconsin Department of Wildlife are carrying out. And the Native Americans were saying it's very interesting that the areas where chronic wasting diseases are occurring are areas that they would never settle in. But, and their reasons were they could hear harsh sounds coming from the earth. And this stopped them settling in the areas which are now chronic wasting disease at the moment. Mm.
So. But how does the sound connect with the environmental pollutants or what's happening in the brain when the copper isn't there? How does that all connect?
Sure. Well, copper has a role as an antioxidant. And if you look at the cochlea in the ear, there's a particular sort of, it's called copper superoxide dismutase, which is involved in cushioning the effects of sound. Ozonin is involved in sound absorption. And when there's copper deficiency, you don't have this kind of front line of protection against the impact of sound, you know, the noxious side effects of sound that we don't want to, we don't need really for our sort of physiological, you know, survival, you know. So when you've got the wrong metal in there, then they can form these sort of what's called a sort of hyperacusis effect. It's audio sensitivity. And it's well known amongst people who are into ototoxicity, which means sound toxicity, that certain metal contaminations cause a hypersensitivity to sound, which I might add is a prime feature of BSE and the TSE disease process. And, you know, having had BSE cows that I brought into my own herd, you just have to clink the chain on a milking parlour, which is a normal sound, you know, that the cow experiences. And a BSE cow will just go mad. It just hears the clink and it will lurch up like that, completely freaking out. And in fact, the test that the British Ministry of Agriculture used was the simple hand clap test. When you yarded up a cow of suspected BSE, they'd come into the pen and if they gumped when you... That, you know, the veterinary officer would say, yeah, well, we'll put her on the suspect list of BSE. So audio sensitivity is a crucial kind of pivotal clinical hallmark of this disease. And that's typical if you've got the wrong metals in the cochlea in the ear or like in the retina in the eye. And interestingly, the first lesions in the BSE disease process appear in the retina and the cochlea, which suggests that damage is initiating from, not from the gut. You know, if meat and bone meal were the cause, then you'd expect to see if the feed was the cause, you'd expect to see the prion proteins in the gut wall, which is where they do exist, getting malformed first of all, rather than what is really happening, which appears in the retina and the cochlea in the ear, which are in the front line of receiving sound and light and these kind of harsh toxic properties that can trigger off this disease process.
But with regard to the sound, it's not just, I mean, we don't have volcanoes here.
Sure.
But we have the one mad cow and the concern over the chronic wasting disease.
Yeah.
What else is there?
Well, I think in the more modern strains of disease, there's artificial forms of sound have dramatically increased in our environment, particularly produces this low frequency sound. And, you know, military shooting ranges are a prime, you know, a lot of JD victims have been in people who are in the military. You know, even shooters have been getting... you know, it's been blamed on eating venison, but I mean, these people are going out shooting high-powered rifles all the time. They're exposing themselves to this very sonic shock, which is what I believe kind of does the final flip on the protein to cause the disease. You know.
And they hold the gun up to their ear.
Yeah, exactly. It's nothing to do with venison consumption. You know, maybe, and those deer that are being shot at, you invariably shoot at a bunch of deer, like maybe half or a dozen deer, and only one gets killed. You know, what about those remaining deer that received the full shock blast? It seems to be these kind of environments where there is a sonic shock element. And in Britain, I think, you know, low-flying military jets, which, because there's so many depopulated areas in North America, a lot of the low-flying training is done over areas where there are no humans, you know, up at the Cold Lake weapons range, for instance, and along through Labrador and in areas where there's no human occupation. But of course, you know, it is, has us happen to be where areas where, you know, deer are living and therefore are receiving the shot blasts of these sound waves that are produced by these infrasonic producing kind of...
What about in Britain?
Well, in Britain, there was an awful lot of, it's still going on today, low-flying aircraft. I mean, they come really low over my farm. On the average day, you probably experience about, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 low-flying tornado aircraft coming over every day. You know, they're so low you can see the pilot, and you know, they'll just send a child into total convulsions. You know, it's and then Britain and France, the two countries with variant CJD, of course, developed the Concorde aircraft, which. And if you look at the clusters of variant CJD, they seem to be in these small rural areas, which is where, you know, the airports have been built. And they're all under the flight paths of where these aeroplanes are taking off and therefore exposed to the maximum amounts of low-frequency noise. So if you are unlucky enough to live under an airport flight path and you're exposed to this abnormal mineral imbalance, however it's produced, then you've got a chance of getting the disease.
Now, why would it be just some people who are exposed to those kinds of factors, yeah, and not everyone?
Well, I suppose, you know, we live in such a mixed kind of culture society these days, and there's obviously a strong genetical susceptibility element to these diseases. And as with any disease, it's always going to be the one individual that is more susceptible to the disease than other people. I mean, for instance, if one of the factors is to do with copper deficiency, then that might link to a genetically inherited inadequacy of the gut wall to absorb copper from the diet. It could be as simple as that. Or it could be maybe an individual's body is throwing out copper, excreting it too efficiently. It could be the blood-brain barrier function is not taking up enough copper. A lot of copper is transported into the brain through a protein called transferrin, and maybe if that protein isn't expressed or manufactured very efficiently in one individual, then they're not enough copper going into the brain in the first place. So it's a sort of myriad of possibilities that all of these kind of things need to be looked at, but the way our modern scientific sort of institutions operate is they go down the reductionist sort of mindset track, and you know, they want the silver bullet that is causing this disease. They're not into multifactorial, particularly environmental factors, because for governments and big corporations, looking at environmental factors would invariably mean that you know, they're going to be in the shooting line for perhaps being responsible for the cause of this disease in some way. And that then throws up alarm bells, which, you know, signal massive compensation claims.
You've been doing all this work, all this investigation on your own. You're not associated with any research institute, with any university. Why are you doing this?
I suppose I feel very concerned about the way, you know, our environment is being mistreated by you know, big, basically, and we're in a world that is increasingly being monopolised by big corporations. The sort of negative effects are not only just environmental, which kind of impacts on our health and a myriad of modern diseases like cancers, multiple sclerosis, you name it, but it's also affecting our whole sort of social, cultural kind of perspectives on life. And for instance, you know, where they're currently eradicating all the peasants' goat flocks off the Pyrenees because they have 3% carry the scrapie susceptible gene. You know, this ridiculous sort of wholesale eradication. This is the mainstay of the peasant lifestyle. You know, a lot of their music, a lot of their art is based around the goat, you know. And these kind of corporation-backed governments are moving in and just taking out the lifeblood of these artistically very beautiful sort of environments and culture.
But you have to pay for this. Most people, when they're involved with research, they do it based on grants, and you are driven. Plus the fact that you know, you don't have a PhD behind your name.
Sure, yeah.
How do you deal with those things?
Well, I suppose I'm just following my, I don't know what it is really, something is driving me to do this, you know. I must say I've had a kind of lot of help from, it hasn't been all hard graft. I mean, I know it's a lot of donkey work, trekking off, you know, I often end up sleeping rough in the mountains, which I actually enjoy, you know. I don't like sort of five-star hotels and that kind of sensitizes you against, you know, some of the more beautiful things in life, you know. I've had a lot of pleasure out of it. I've met some amazing people, and I'm actually sort of writing a book about my journeys where I've, you know, been helped by bizarre individuals, like a group of Hell's Angels, for instance, helped me in Colorado, you know.
Oh, tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I was going on a mountain bike collecting samples that a guy I'd met had lent me out. And I went through this canyon where I think a group of Hell's Angels from Denver were encamped, and they kind of started laughing at me because I sort of looked a bit pathetic on this bicycle. But then they took me quite seriously and started asking questions. What the hell I was doing collecting soil, you know. And because I was anti-government, they eventually worked out I was anti-government. This guy said, wow, gee, you know, get on the back of my motorbike, man. You come on. And he spent like 4 days collecting all my samples for me. You know, I got on the back of his bike and we collected samples. And it was great, you know, and then it's happened again in Calabria. I was led to this sort of the link with the mafia by this guy. Yeah, he was actually a film star in one of the motorbike movies. What's it? Mad Max. That's right. Yeah. So I've met some extraordinary people, and you know, I lived with a group of Aborigines on an island off Australia. That's been involved in my work. Group of Amish farmers. Native Americans I've met and been having contact with. You know, some bizarre hillbilly kind of individuals, you know, which has really made life worth living. I mean, what 9-to-5er would have this kind of experience, you know?
I've read some of your work, and the thing that really struck me and made me want to find out more is that you seem to put scientific rigor. You seem comfortable in talking with all these different terms and how many charges are on different elements and that sort of thing. There's something within you that gives you that curious mind.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sort of appear big-headed or anything, but I mean, if throughout history, I think it's maverick kind of individuals like myself that haven't been trained, channeled along a certain specific line, who I think people from the ground have more of a broader insight into the workings of biology and the way the world works. And I think it's because of that freedom, the lack of boundaries in my life, the multidisciplinary perspectives that I've been interested in, has enabled me to sort of interpret my observations around these cluster areas, the observations which to the average person would be, they'd be too embarrassed to even begin to mention it, you know, supersonic planes or something. I mean, we're dealing with a new kind of invisible force that, you know, might take generations to sort of get recognized as being something that really is toxic, you know. But
well, when you consider that Scientific American publishes articles on parallel universes and it's their cover story,
yeah,
you know, it's not that far to start thinking about some of these other things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's all things might seem ridiculous when they kick off, but I think what frustrates me is that with a lot of these cases, you know, people are dying. I mean, I always use the example of the limey sailor who used to bring lemons and limes on boats transatlantic voyages in the olden days to cure himself of scurvy. It took 250 years for the medical profession to recognize that, you know, it was the vitamin C that was curing scurvy. And during those 250 years, thousands of sailors were dying needlessly. You know, had that sailor been listened to, instead of being condescendingly rebuffed by sort of the medical, you know, the rather conceited medical profession, then all those people might not needed to have died. And what we're talking about here is life and death situations, you know, whether it's CJD, you know, BSE, whatever. You know, a lot of mammals are dying in sort of grotesque sort of conditions, which, you know, if the scientific profession did their job properly, we could, you know, eradicate a lot of these problems, which and the suffering that goes with it.
You did start off in zoology, though.
Yeah, that's right. I kind of started off in, you know, at university in the 70s, and I studied zoology and psychology. But back then, it was sort of hippie days, I suppose, and I wanted to... actually, I tried to start a community in Western Ireland with friends, and where we were going to farm organically. And that's, I think, partly why I chucked in university, because I just wanted to get on with a practical lifestyle, living in a kind of idealistic, you know, social kind of dream that I'd envisioned, you know, with my friends. But slowly I've come back to academia again, because I feel you need academia to in order to prove these anecdotal observations that sort of this kind of insight, you know.
You're here in Alberta. Today you spoke to people interested in elk farming, and they're concerned about chronic wasting disease. You're traveling around. What are you going to do here, and what advice to your people right now as we go through this crisis?
I mean, I think this whole situation in Alberta is absolutely appalling. For a start, in real terms, it isn't a crisis. One BSE cow is just no more than a case of Alzheimer's disease. You know, the transmissibility of this disease, the whole hyperinfectious hypothesis, is built up on the fact that you can transmit the disease in the laboratory, underlined, by injecting brain material from a cow that's died of the disease into an animal that is healthy, and then you produce the disease in the animal. But you can do this with all sorts of other diseases, like Alzheimer's disease, thyroiditis. And so why aren't we freaking out about Alzheimer's disease? So I think the first issue is to recognise that, in real terms, we don't have a crisis. What we've got is a mythical crisis that has been sort of pumped up by, you know, various political agendas. For instance, the Americans running a trade war against your beef. So they pump up, you know, milk this hyperinfectious hypothesis. And it is a hypothesis, it's no more than that. In order to protect, you know, their own beef industry and expand their own beef industry and get one over on the Canadians. But in real scientific terms, at the end of the day, there really is no problem at all, you know. And I think that's what's got to be recognised. But obviously the Canadian government are in a very difficult position, because if they're dealing with a competing government that is throwing the hyperinfectious hypothesis at them, saying they're not going to take their beef until they conform to, you know, mass eradication or whatever, then they've clearly got to run along with that in order to get their beef taken again. But
should people be giving their animals then copper supplements?
Yeah, I mean, I think is one way of, I believe, of preventing the disease. I don't think you could cure it. Not curing it. It's to actually put down feed blocks with a copper additive in. The copper would then essentially protect the prion protein against uptake of these environmental radioactive metals, and therefore prevent the disease process from occurring. And I think if I was a rancher in the high-risk area, the environmental area where these diseases seem to be being sourced from, in the Sandhills area of Manitou Lake region, in that kind of area, then I would be putting down feed blocks for the sort of with copper in for the wild deer, any cattle in that area as well. You know, there's also a sound element there from, you know, the nearby Camp Wainwright that is blasting off sort of tank rounds throughout the summer. And then the copper would protect those animals against those low-frequency sound waves for the environment.
Are you getting some interest now in the work that you've done from the more mainstream organizations?
Yes, I mean, I think mainstream organizations have been a bit schizophrenic towards my work, but, you know, publicly they'll kind of discredit me, rubbish me, every opportunity they've got to do that. But it seems to be another story. You know, I often get asked up to these meetings. Well, I've had a meeting 6 weeks ago with the Minister of the Environment and Minister of Defence in Britain. And, you know, they kind of privately said my work should be funded, it's got to be funded, you know. If I was the idiot they publicly make me out to be, what in the hell are they having me up for to, you know, in a sense, it would be wasting their time if it was true what they were telling the public. But, and often when I go to these meetings, there are up to sort of 70 officials, and they write down every word I say. You know, if I was the... And I kind of think to myself, what's going on here? Publicly, they're saying I'm a fool. And privately, they're writing down every word as I'm speaking the gospel. You know, it just doesn't add up. And... then I begin to wonder that I'm really being naive going up there, telling them all my work, which has cost me my own money to do the donkey work and the research, when they should have been funding me in the first place. And it can be very frustrating, you know.
What are you doing next?
Next I'm going off to Australia, where I've got to speak in a conference at Cairns, where I deliver a paper that I've just had accepted for publication. And I'm going on to the Isle of Guam in the South Pacific, where the native population suffer Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, motor neurone disease at 50 times the international incidence rate in these islanders. And I'm going to carry out a sort of total environmental analysis, like I've done with the spongiform diseases, to see if I keep on finding, you know, another common denominator that I've been finding in the mineral balance of these areas. I mean, basically, I think all these neurodegenerative diseases, whether it's Alzheimer's or CJD, are very much the same disease process, you know. They're caused by different genetics, different mineral imbalances that create a kind of free radical toxic impact in the brain with degeneration that is progressive and invariably fatal. But I do believe, you know, if we understood the cause of these diseases, we could treat them. We could, by chelating drugs that kind of lock onto the rogue metal responsible, or you know, preventative minerals like copper or magnesium is another mineral that can prevent other rogue metals sort of getting into the wrong place in the brain, etc. So I think, you know, if we understand the cause of the disease, which is what my research is about, then that offers great hope in eradicating the disease, controlling it properly, and developing a cure. And this is what I wish, you know, governments would start to take up this approach, rather than this rather sort of reductionist, focused approach of just looking at how to basically smother out the outward evidence that this disease occurs, you know, by just suppressing it, keeping it under the carpet. Mass slaughter regimes that are misguided and achieve absolutely nothing in the long term. Because whenever history shows that whenever they eradicated scrapie in Iceland, for instance, where they slaughtered sheep right across northern Iceland, when they restocked the sheep after a fallow period, scrapie would just reappear again. They did this in Colorado with the deer. They eradicated whole areas of the Front Range of the wild deer in the Department of Wildlife. When they reintroduced fresh deer, the disease just broke out again. You know, because I believe, you know, the radioactive metals were there in the soil. There was no copper there. So they would just go down with the disease, you know. You know, near all those cases around quarrying, where there's a lot of quarry blasting, there was supersonic testing there of aircraft from the air base up in Wyoming, at Cheyenne. All the factors are there, you know. And so you're going to get the disease reappearing, however many eradication campaigns you do. And all that eradication do is that all that they achieve is they achieve nothing. They just slaughter healthy animals for no good reason, and they cost the taxpayer a load of money. But they might benefit politicians in, you know, temporarily conning the public that they've dealt with the problem, and so they get voted back in or whatever, and larger research grants to carry on their nonsense control measures.
So where is some of your stuff published, and what's it called?
Well, despite some of the criticism I get, a lot of my work and the people I've been informally collaborating with, the work is published in, you know, peer-reviewed scientific journals in the medical literature. For instance, my work's been published in the Journal of Cattle Practice, the Journal of Medical Hypotheses, the Science of the Total Environment. These are all sort of mainstream scientific journals that can't, you know, publications in those journals can't really be denied as and be completely ignored, you know, because they're peer-reviewed, and, you know, if they pass the peer review system, then I guess they're worthy of publication.
So what issues should people look for?
Well, I think, you know, they can be picked up on my website, www.markpurdey.com. On the science page, on my bio page, all my publications are listed there quite clearly.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much indeed. Yeah.